ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For 50 years, NAIDOC Week has honoured and elevated the voices of First Nations communities, grounded in culture and strong in identity. This NAIDOC Week, celebrate Black excellence with programs like Away, Speaking Out, and Word Up. As we mark 50 years of Deadly, this week and every week, right here on ABC Radio National.
Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Global Roaming. What's really interesting about this particular episode is how popular it was. We found that intriguing because, to be honest, our guest did not pull any punches. There are some positives to emerge from this conversation, even as interest rates were rising during the spring and the summer. This is Global Roaming.
Hello, and welcome to the final instalment of Getting Lucky Again.
You still feeling lucky, Jerry?
I am, actually.
We've been inviting a cast of really interesting thinkers to help us ponder some fresh ideas for Australia's future in security, politics, media, foreign policy as well. And on this episode, we're talking about the really big one, the economy.
Yes, so much of Australia's good fortune in the recent past has been linked to our mineral wealth, but that will run out. Do we grasp that we'll have to do a lot more and be cleverer to maintain our economic edge into the future?
So, as always, with each episode in this series, we want to hear from someone who is thinking about this particular dimension of the topic deeply. And today, that someone is Michael Stutchbury. He was formerly the editor-in-chief of the Australian Financial Review. Occasionally, you'd see him on the couch at Insiders. And now he is the executive director of the Centre for Independent Studies.
And Michael is here in person, which is always a thrill. So we'll let you take it away, Michael.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks, Hamish. Look, as inflation has bubbled back up, the pundits have started speculating that the Reserve Bank will increase interest rates again rather than cut them. Struggling to tackle their budget deficits, federal and state governments have withdrawn electricity bill subsidies that have been suppressing CPI inflation. After the reassuring talk of a soft landing for the economy, more people are getting antsy about the cost of living squeeze again, because, you know, prices haven't fallen back to where they were before the pandemic. They're just rising less rapidly than before. Politicians dutifully express sympathy that people are doing it tough. And rising house prices stoke fears that the next generation of Australians might be poorer than their parents. Yet, do Australians appreciate just how affluent they are today? Just posing that question risks being accused of being out of touch with the struggles of everyday people. But as the Reserve Bank's imported English Deputy Governor, Andrew Houser, says, it can be easy to forget just how prosperous modern Australia is. We are in the top echelon of global affluence, Houser says. And yes, at a macro level, Australia's per capita GDP is 10 to 15% higher than in Germany and Sweden. It's 20 to 25% higher than in the UK or Canada. And by the same measure, basically of national income per head of population, Australians are 80 to 90% more prosperous than the South Koreans or the Japanese, and four times more affluent than those miserable Russians. It begs the questions, why? Do Australians work harder than the South Koreans or the Japanese? Are we smarter than the Germans or the Swedes? People rightly scoff when I ask those questions, but then I say to people, you realise, don't you, that Australians have been as relatively prosperous as this before, only to let it slip. And that's what's happening now. We're not really in danger of becoming a banana republic, like Paul Keating warned in 1986, but we are losing our exceptional prosperity and sliding back into the pack of the other less prosperous developed economies. After World War II, for example, Australia's per capita income jumped in the early 1950s, when the price of our biggest export was then wool, tripled due to soaring American demand. But less than a decade after the Korean War wool boom collapsed, we started to run out of foreign reserves needed to pay for imports and had to be bailed out by the International Monetary Fund. Australia unexpectedly boomed again from the mid-1960s when we opened up the Pilbara on the back of demand for our iron ore from newly industrialising Japan. But that boom blew up in the stagflationary 1970s, along with the Whitlam government. By the end of that decade, Singapore's founder Lee Kuan Yew warned that Australia risked becoming the poor white trash of Asia. But Australia's modern prosperity, what we feel today, comes from two fabulous decades of growth from the early 1990s. This started with a productivity bonus from the bipartisan policy decisions to open up the economy to market forces and global competition. Floating the Aussie dollar, deregulating the financial system, lowering the import tariff wall, privatising government enterprises such as the Commonwealth Bank and Telstra, ending centralised wage fixing, injecting competition into government monopolies such as for electricity, reducing income tax rates by introducing the GST, and by giving an independent reserve bank the responsibility to tackle inflation. Then, from the early 2000s came the unexpected boost from China's booming demand for Australia's iron ore, which by then had become our biggest export. Now, in those fabulous two decades, the purchasing power of Australian households, otherwise known as our standard of living, jumped by two-thirds. Australia became a prosperous nation. We even sailed through the global financial crisis without a recession. But this latest prosperity boom peaked around 2011 or 2012, along with the US dollar's $180 per tonne iron ore price. And for the decade plus since then, Australia's envied affluence has gradually slipped away. It's happening for two reasons. First, because of a lower iron ore price that we can't do much about. But second, because of bipartisan policy failures that have undone or reversed the policy choices that helped make us affluent in the first place. Instead of remembering what it takes to grow the pie, the political process has resorted to squabbling over its shrinking slices. The result is that Australia is becoming more of a low-growth, European-style, welfare state economy, when we should be a high-growth, frontier economy that attracts the world's best talent and its saving to our above-average investment opportunities. The productivity of the Australian economy, or the amount of goods and services it produces for each unit of labour input, today is hardly above the level of 2016. A step down in productivity growth has prompted the Reserve Bank to cut its estimate of how rapidly the Australian economy can grow each year, in real terms, to just 2% before it runs into so-called capacity constraints. These constraints, in turn, limit how much tax the federal government collects as it confronts a projected decade of budget deficits and $1 trillion public debt. It's why real wages are languishing at 2011 levels. And it forces the Reserve Bank to keep interest rates elevated to keep overall spending or demand within the economy's ability to supply extra goods and services. But what's caused this productivity and growth slowdown? Yes, it is a global phenomenon, but after being feted for its exceptionalism, Australia has become an international economic laggard, according to The Economist magazine. First has been the growth in the size of government. The government share of the economy has grown between 3 and 6 percentage points since before the pandemic. The two fabulous decades of prosperity inflated voter expectations of what governments could deliver and finance. These expectations got locked into political promises, such as for the NDIS and the Gonski school spending, even as national income growth slowed sharply. Once the pandemic hit, middle-class voters seemed happy for governments to borrow more to supply them with more non-means-tested benefits, such as electricity bill subsidies or universal childcare. As the Centre for Independent Studies economist Robert Carling has pointed out, it appears that at least half the voting population now relies on government for at least half of its income. It's promoting a culture of dependency. And most of the so-called care economy is relatively low productivity, so its rapid expansion has dragged down the overall economy's productivity. Second, the tax system continues to rely too much on taxing enterprise and initiative. Projections for how the federal budget deficit will be closed over the next decade rely on a decade of bracket creep tax hikes on workers. That is taxation by stealth. The 47% top marginal income tax rate encourages enterprising Australians with big ideas to move offshore, say to the US. And Paul Keating says that Australia's top tax rate should be no higher than 39 cents in the dollar. The Productivity Commission has documented how Australia's 30% company tax rate has become uncompetitive by international standards. That makes investing in Australia less attractive, which in turn undermines our productivity. Third, Paul Keating's big shift from centralised wage fixing in the early 1990s sought to promote productivity-based enterprise bargaining at the shop floor level. But Rudd Gillard and now Albanese Labor have re-regulated the nation's work rules in ways that undermine this. Reintroducing so-called pattern bargaining delivers uniform work and pay rules across businesses that are supposed to compete against each other. And don't tell me that imposing new rights from working from home makes businesses more productive. Fourth, Australia's cheap energy advantage traditionally has allowed us to sustain a high-wage economy. This cheap energy, of course, was based on plentiful supplies of low-cost coal-fired electricity that attracted energy-hungry smelters in the 1970s and 1980s. Harnessing cheap wind and solar power was supposed to turn Australia into a clean energy superpower. Instead, energy costs are going up as the share of renewables increases. Australia has lost our cheap energy advantage, exposing our high-wage and low-productivity growth economy. Governments are being forced to subsidise smelters to keep them operating. That's another form of the import protection that we got rid of in the 1980s and 90s because it kept uncompetitive industries going. Fifth, what the Productivity Commission calls the ever-growing burden of red tape, regulation and compliance is drowning business in unproductive activity. The Centre for Independent Studies has changed the housing debate in Australia, and it's now accepted that zoning and planning restrictions, rather than tax breaks for investors, are the main cause of excessive house prices and rents. But the regulations that make housing so unaffordable are just an example of the supply-side restrictions across the economy, from opening a coffee shop to building renewable energy transmission lines to opening a new mine. Today, governments impose all sorts of new burdens on businesses, such as requiring them to figure out and disclose the carbon emissions of their customers in another country, to ensuring that none of their customers seek to launder ill-gotten gains, to engineer gender equality, and to maintaining the mental health of their employees. This is the modern regulatory state. The Macquarie Group has put its annual compliance burden as high as $1.2 billion. Now, Australia is still a prosperous nation. As the Reserve Bank's Andrew Houser says, we're still blessed with extraordinary mineral resources, world-ranking universities, a plum geographical position in the Asia Pacific, a huge retirement savings pool, relatively low public debt, a strong banking system, proven political and economic institutions, and a track record of openness to foreign capital and labour. But it's really up to us whether we want to entrench these exceptional advantages into exceptional prosperity for the next generations of Australia, or are we prepared to let them slip back into the pack of low-growth developed nations?
Michael, thank you very much for that. Lots to think about. I can see Geraldine madly scribbling.
I love all this stuff.
Not madly. That's unfair. But scribbling furiously. Let me remind you that this is ABC Radio National's Global Roaming, and we've just been hearing from the Executive Director of the Centre for Independent Studies, Michael Stutchbury. Geraldine, do you want to kick off the questions?
Well, yes, I do. Gosh, I've got lots of questions. I mean, I wonder how you'd change the internal debate, Michael. You said that expectations among Australians have altered dramatically, which contribute to what you're defining as a problem. How would you have the conversation, the pithy conversation that changes the barbecue discussions around what we do next?
Well, I think you've got to look at what is happening out there right now. And you can see that people are getting disappointed with what's happening, say, in the economy. So we've got this combination of slow growth in the economy. We can't really get the economy growing very fast. And if the pie doesn't grow, then there's less for everybody around and they end up just squabbling over it. But as the Reserve Bank says, demand is higher than supply. The overall spending in the economy, the consumers spend, that businesses spend on new investment, the overall spending is higher than the economy can supply. And that's the capacity constraints. Now, this is a bit of a new debate that Australians haven't had to grapple with. And so the question is, why aren't we able to grow to deliver the increased goods and services that we sort of come to expect by the demand, the amount we want to try and spend? Mm. Because when we try and do that, and supply is less than demand, it spills over to inflation, puts interest rates up, and the Reserve Bank's got to stop the economy from growing. We need to get a faster growth economy.
So I've listened to what you've just said, but for me, there's also the global picture. And I wonder how you position Australia in that. Do you think Australians are sort of satisfied looking at, you know, they might look at the GDP figures or their current interest rates and say, look, this is not exactly what I want. I wish things were better, but I'm pleased I don't live in the United States. I'm pleased I moved from Europe all those years ago. I'm in a much better spot where I am.
Actually, just to come in, because that's really in a way what I was saying is that in a way I think you're saying to the Australian people, hey, we're at a very important point. We could slip backwards now. We might all have to think differently. That's what I was trying. How you have that, it's a tough message, you know what I mean? It's the sort of thing that Paul Keating would have done, you know, we're becoming a banana republic. Who's talking like that these days?
Well, not too many. I think we've got to face up to the reality of the situation. Do we want to have a place that is as relatively affluent and prosperous that we as we have lived through since the bounce out of the early 90s recession and we became one of the most prosperous countries in the world? Do we want to keep that? It's a decision. Maybe we don't. But you should then understand that you won't have as much resources to spend, for example, on universal childcare. Because the governments are spending beyond their means, and you can see this pressure coming through in Canberra now, this talk of 5% cuts in government spending coming, you know, it's all a bit subterranean, what are they talking about? But if at some stage, this is a global thing, governments are spending too much, and at some stage there's going to be a reaction in the bond markets, and Australia being a commodity exporting economy, arse into the world, as Paul Keating used to say, then we need to get our foundations ship shape.
But then there are economists that would argue things like the clean energy transition, which you've referred to, getting in and doing that now is going to deliver dividends to us as a nation in the longer term. Do you disagree with that?
Well, I think the reality of it is that we were promised that electricity prices are going to fall because solar and wind are free and all this sort of thing. I think it is.
And they are. I mean, the government is right, isn't it, in saying that those are the cheapest forms of new energy into the market right now. That is cheaper than getting new gas or anything else into the market.
I think that is a question. That is a open question, because it is sort of like, you know, you think, oh yes, the sun shines for free and the wind blows. But the wind doesn't always blow. And this doesn't say that you shouldn't do the clean energy transition. Yeah. But it is saying that contrary to what was sold, it is not, you don't end up being a clean energy superpower.
So it's the conversation again that you have with the Australian
people. You need to know that this is costly. So that means we've always had this cheap energy advantage we've had has enabled us, for example, to sustain a high wage economy. Now, if you lose that cheap energy advantage, then your whole competitiveness changes. And we've got to make our way in the world. So all those
smelters... But then you're saying that there's too much government spending. And, you know, if you take the example of Tomago, you know, government has to step in to keep that alive.
Do they?
Well, who's going to pay for it?
Well, maybe it needs to close, because the reality is that was based on the idea that we had cheap coal-fired electricity. We no longer have that. We may not be able to sustain that level of further processing of our natural resource base. Australia's rich because we export today close to 1 billion tonnes of iron ore. Now, just write that down, 1 billion tonnes of iron ore every year. That's what our comparative advantage is our natural resource base. That's the reality of how we've become an extra prosperous nation. Now, we've tried to do some extra processing of things, and that's a good thing to try to do. But if you lose your cheap energy advantage, you can go shift all this to Canada, and they've got hydro, and that's cheaper and it's cleaner.
Okay, so where do we go from here then? What are the solutions that you are suggesting for us to be alert to all of this and then to become more productive while remembering, you haven't mentioned inequality once. You know, it's generally accepted that inequality, a perceived inequality in advanced countries, is leading to a great deal of political instability. Now, how do you move everybody forward so that they feel they've got a share, or do you not aim to do that?
Well, I think the inequality thing is much less of a thing in Australia. One, we've become a much richer country over the last few decades. The studies of Australia shows that inequality of income have not widened that much at all.
But access to housing, though, that sort of puts a dent in
those housing
numbers,
right? Well, housing is the one area
If you're a young person today, and hearing you say that, you think, come on, I'm never going to be able to buy a house.
Sure, but that is the one area. We've got today the richest, I'd say, probably the richest old people in the world. And when I was growing up, we used to think of pensioners as being poor and eating dog food. That was the sort of thing you'd say. We've got the wealthiest old people in the world. So we've had a system which has funneled the increase in the wealth of the nation, if you like, through the tax system and the social security system through into housing. And that's where a lot of the assets has been invested of ordinary Australians.
Well, it's become an asset class. When you and I were growing
up. Now, added to that has been, and this comes to the crux of it, that the reason why house prices are so high are because of artificial restrictions on planning and zoning, which has stopped the market, if you like, from producing the sort of houses that we demand. So Chris Minns came to a CIS
New South Wales
Labor Premier, and said that Sydney had the second highest housing prices of any city in the world, but we're the 800th least dense city in the world. You look at cities, suburbs like Woollahra, leafy inner city suburbs, where they're now going to put in a railway station which got abandoned in the 1970s and build a lot of flats around it. The population of Woollahra over the last 30 years has fallen because all the big houses there, families grow older, the kids move out, the parents have got nowhere else to move in their area, there's no medium density housing. So it's the restrictions on the supply side of regulations on the economy which has stopped the housing market in Australia from building more houses.
I want to jump in here because I worry we risk turning this into a very domestic debate about arguments we're very familiar with. And I want to ask you about Australia's place, particularly in this region. If we're looking for the opportunities, we sit geographically in the fastest growing economic region the world has ever seen, Southeast Asia. And I know diplomatically we've made efforts, but do you think we're seizing the economic opportunity that our region presents?
Well, Australia has been a case study in taking opportunities in East Asia over the past 50 years. You know, we totally realigned our economy from being based on Britain. We were part of the sterling bloc until, you know, the 1950s and into the 1960s. And we realigned our whole economy around being a supplier of raw materials to the industrializing nations of, particularly to start off with, Northeast Asia, Japan, Korea, South Korea, Taiwan, and then China. So we've done a huge realignment of our economy and become part of the Asian economic zone.
But as that region develops and becomes, they become more modernized economies and lift vast quantities, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, what's the opportunity for Australia to diversify what we trade with them?
Yeah, it's good to concentrate on what you do best and what you can make the most money out of. But at the same time, it's good not to put all your eggs in one basket and to diversify. We have advantages in, for example, higher education. So we have built a very big export market on education services. Unfortunately, now we're taking a bit of an axe to it and deliberately cutting back our foreign students. Now there's a whole debate
because that relates into the migration debate.
And that relates to housing.
All of that. So, you know, we could, you know, this is one area where we're deliberately coming back. And it's probably a bit unfortunate that that is one area where we could do well. We've got a sophisticated services sector in Australia and financial services. Now, we might, if there was a lot of talk about Australia and Sydney becoming an Asian financial centre and so forth. We're not really serious about it. If we wanted to be a Hong Kong or a Singapore, we wouldn't have, for example, such high taxation.
But would
in the
you
country.
Do? Would you?
That's
do,
the reality of it.
But would you do a special taxation zone within a city like Sydney? Like, obviously, there's not a great appetite for radically reducing corporate tax rates in Australia right now. But would you come up with a special economic zone to become that? Would it be worth it?
Look, I'm not a big fan of, you know, carving out areas in the economy to say, well, they get a special rate on this, that, or the other. I think the overall thing. But cutting the company tax rate is not such a radical thing. Like, it wasn't that long ago that all the Labor politicians lined up saying and agreeing, you cut the company tax rate, you get more investment in Australia, it increases the return to investing in Australia, you get more capital investment here, you get more tools that Australian workers can work with, they become more productive and they can get higher wages.
I was waiting for you to get to this. Well, I thought
I know it doesn't, you know, it doesn't sound good.
Well, the point is that underneath it all is this question of perceived inequality. That's why I stressed it. Like, in terms of your offering, do you say, in effect to some Australians, look, some of you will have to lose for a while in order to gain later. How do you get a more dynamic economy, which is what I think you want, with more competition, more jobs, better wages, I think you want, without somebody, like some are going to go ahead faster than others, aren't they? Is there any way of avoiding that?
Well, going ahead faster than others is not necessarily a bad thing, because that's people going out and getting opportunities. And we've seen great examples of that in Australia. You know, people now, young people, there are some young people who can go out in this globalised economy from Australia and start up very quickly global businesses.
We've and you'd seen, like to see more of that?
Of course, right? Atlassian. That's only 15 years old. Canberra, I think, was started in 2012. These are started from nothing with people with just ingenuity starting up things in Australia.
But so you there's can a big global shift that we're all observing, which is that the centre-right of politics is drifting further right, and they're drifting away from some of those economic arguments. Andrew Hastie here putting out these videos talking about making Holdens in Australia and manufacturing these things. Is that an answer to anything?
No, that's nuts. And it is true that the right, the centre-right, is sort of going out, becoming more government interventionist, even more government spending.
Do you think it's inspired by Trump? Is it just a symptom of the inequality Geraldine's talking about that people feel? What do you apportion it to?
Look, like in the politics over the last 10, 15 years has used to be, in the over the past century, it was really Labor v. Capital. It's moved from Capital v. Labor to really being about culture and identity. So you get the phenomenon of a MAGA movement, which is in part a reaction against Chinese competition, which we've done very well on, actually. So it doesn't play here as well, because Australians have got rich on the Chinese manufacturing, which has hollowed out some of the US economy and produced MAGA. But you're right, the right has split off and gone into some protectionist areas. The Liberals, the centre-right, is going through really the fracturing of the political process around culture and identity and this. But it's happening on the left as well. You know, the left used to be Hawke Keating. The left is no longer that. And you see this around in, particularly in the US, where the left has gone, you know, Mamdani in New York.
Mm. Not in Australia. You've got a 94-seat majority Albanese government that's middle of the road.
What you've got is really a sort of Whitlam light thing, where government spending is increased by up to 6 percentage points of GDP, 3 to 6% of GDP. And it's the attempt to get most of the middle class sort of on the idea of entitlement. In the end, these things have to actually deliver.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Hamish. Thanks, Jerry.
In our final episode of Your Favourites, we're looking at an issue touched on by Alan Finkel, the former chief scientist, this time about clean energy. It is a vital and energetic conversation. That's coming up next on Global Roaming. I'm Hamish McDonald. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.